Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the home theater geek and editor of ABSForum.com. This week, I'm at the National Association of Broadcasters Convention in lovely Las Vegas, Nevada. I'll be visiting a bunch of booths, talking to people about all the latest and greatest gear here at NAB, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded April 19th, 2016. Episode 301, live from NAB 2016. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Curiosity Stream, a subscription streaming service that offers over 1,400 documentaries and nonfiction series from the world's greatest filmmakers. Get unlimited access starting at just $2.99 a month, and for our audience, the first 2 months are completely free if you sign up at curiositystream.com/twit and use the offer code TWIT. And by Epson's new EcoTank printers. With Epson's line of SuperTank all-in-one printers, you can print thousands of documents without running out of ink. EcoTank is loaded and ready to print when you are. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank to find out more. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the home theater geek and editor of AVSForum.com. This week, I'm in lovely Las Vegas, Nevada at the National Association of Broadcasters Convention, where I'll be visiting a bunch of booths and talking to a bunch of people about all the wonderful gear that is being introduced here at the show. So come on, let's check it out. Here in the Futures Park section of NAB, we are witnessing the world's first demonstration of ATSC 3.0, the new broadcast standard for digital television. I'm speaking with Rich Chernock, Chief Science Officer at Triveni Digital, one company of many that's involved in this demonstration. Rich, why don't you take us through the signal flow here? What exactly is being demonstrated today?
So what's being demonstrated is live broadcast over ATSC 3.0. In the back, which I think you'll see later, is a camera, high dynamic range camera, filming live. The signal from the camera comes into this rack over here. The rack contains all the television station equipment to take the uncompressed feed, compress it, segment it, put it into digital form over IP. It is then sent up to Black Mountain, where there's a transmitter. Black Mountain, all of the RF magic is done, modulation, turning the digital bits into analog signals, applying all the error correction that makes mobile reception possible, filtering, applying the bandpass filter that allows adjacent channels to be received, amplified then up to the transmitter. The transmitter tower sends out a broadcast signal, so all of Las Vegas is receiving this ATSC 3 signal. An antenna on the other side of the hall, up in the front that you'll see later on, is receiving the signal. It's being brought down to televisions with ATSC 3.0 tuner chips decoded and displayed. So what we have is the entire live chain for live broadcast of television over the next generation broadcast system, ATSC 3.
Now, we see a diagram here of this entire chain. Why don't you point out the important road or moments there in the path?
Okay, so this diagram is admittedly a little bit simplified, but this shows the entire broadcast chain. So this portion is the TV station. What happens behind the closed doors?
Which is basically where we're standing now.
Correct. Yes, this is all built up in this area. It goes from origination, cameras, 4K, ultra-high UHD, including high dynamic range, wide color, and so on. It would normally go through production steps and master control, but this is very simple. There's no switching. There's no extra things added. So it goes directly from the camera into the equipment rack here, which is what would be hidden away in the back of the station.
And the companies represented in that equipment rack include?
Oh, quite a few. So, Triveni Digital, I'll go first since I'm standing here.
Sure.
Dolby, Harmonic, Teamcast, Monroe, Emergency Alerting, and others. That's it.
Oh, okay.
For this set. Okay.
So what does what do each of those companies contribute to the whole thing?
And the reason I kind of hesitated, there are so many companies involved in demos here, and there are so many involved in ATSC3, I didn't want to leave someone out. So they're actually, we're all partnered. We're all doing what our companies are best at. Again, I'll start with Triveni. We work with the metadata, with monitoring, with putting things that aren't audio and video. So we put in all the program guide information. We put in the signaling that lets the TV figure out which streams of bits go together to make the television program. So you end up, for example, with the audio and video from the same show together.
That would be good.
It's very good. It's kind of disconcerting if it doesn't work that way. Dolby is dealing with the audio, AC4, the immersive and personalized audio. Big, big enhancement in the next generation of broadcast TV. Harmonic is doing the encoding and segmenting, compressing gigabits of raw video into megabits of encoded video using HEVC, which is the next newest generation of video coding, as well as segmenting to send files similar to how video is done over the internet. So another big change in broadcast.
So tell me a little bit about that. Segmenting is part of ATSC 3.0 as opposed to ATSC 1, which is the current broadcast standard, which is just simply a stream of bits.
Correct. And I'll step back a teeny bit because there's another change below that. So ATSC 1 was built on MPEG-2 transport, breaking up large streams of bits into very small pieces that could be sent. And in a lossy environment, you could lose little bits, work really well for that. The internet popped up. Entertainment's coming across the internet. The internet uses a different mechanism. It sends larger pieces, segments of clips. And the client in the receiver plays them one after the other according to a playlist. Instead of being an independent silo, which broadcasting has been, we've decided that it should really become a wireless part of the internet. So things can now change. Broadcasters can send things over broadcast, can send other things over broadband and have them combined in the television. So the change to Internet Protocol, IP, instead of MPEG-2 transport, is probably one of the most revolutionary changes in ATSC 3. Stepping up from that, instead of streams of bits, which is what MPEG-2 did, what we did in the previous system, we're sending chunks. So segments of a half a second, one segment, along with a playlist that says play number one, play number two. End result is it's continuous television as far as the viewer is concerned. One of the implications of this is you can substitute things in the receiver. So one possibility is an educational program, and you can have alternate tracks at different points and seamless transitions. Another thing, which is really a big business impact, is you can do ad insertion in the home. So if a viewer was shopping for SUVs, for example, he might want to see ads for SUVs. And if a neighbor was shopping for convertibles, he might want to see ads for convertibles. You can do this now.
So targeted advertising.
Yes, targeted advertising, and that's a big impact. So forgot where I got.
we have the Harmonic encoding. We have the Triveni metadata. We have the Dolby AC4, the audio, that all gets put together somehow and shipped off to a microwave transmitter on the roof of this building.
So there's a link to the transmitter called STL, Station to Transmitter Link. That's sent up to Black Mountain, which is where the TV station is.
How far away is that from here?
30, 40 miles, I think.
Something like that.
Okay. The station has graciously allowed this consortium, this group, to use its transmitter during the show. Up there is equipment that takes in the bitstream, and that equipment is created by TeamCast. Takes the stream of bits. You cannot send bits over the air. You have to send an analog signal. So it does all the magic of modulating using OFDM. The physical layer for ATSC3 is extremely flexible and robust.
The physical layer is?
The RF layer, sorry.
The actual radio signal.
Correct. The signal that goes over the air when you tune to channel 6 or 50 in this case. This is what's actually being received by the antenna. Broadcasters can send very high bitstream for the best possible resolution at the cost of reception capability. Moving receiver may not see that. They can also send very robust signals that can be received in moving cars, in tunnels these days. The cost is I lose bits because I need error correction. Or they can operate anywhere in between or multiple ways simultaneously. So now the broadcaster can do whatever their business model wants. So we go through all that magic, add the error correction, do the modulation, amplify it, send it up to the transmitter, which is the same stick that's been in use, you know, on top of those big towers you always see. The signal's then radiated to cover all of Las Vegas. There's an antenna on the roof over the other portion of the South Hall. The antenna is connected to a television, and there are televisions in the other portion that you'll see later, which contain ATSC3 receiver chips, and those were done by LG, and those are the first of its kind in the world. They receive the signal, undo all the magic from the RF, turn it back into bits, it's decoded, and played back as television.
Now, what you said that you could, the broadcaster, the station, could either choose to send a lot of bits and not so much error correction, or more error correction and fewer bits in order to have more robustness. What is the situation in this demonstration?
In this situation, I think there is sort of a medium case.
You know the bandwidth, the number of the actual bit rate that's being transmitted?
I think it's somewhere in the vicinity of 26 or 27 megabits per second, which is more than today's system. Today is 19.39. And just to give you an idea of the range of this, if you turn the knob one way, you can probably get up over 50 megabits per second. Now, that's not a really strong, it's a fragile signal, but a lot of bits. If you turn it all the way to the other, you might get less than a megabit per second. But the signal, if you put it on an analyzer, you could not see the signal because it's totally masked by noise. There's a portion of the signal which is receivable at minus 6 dB carrier to noise.
So how can a receiver even see it, extract it out of that?
It's magic. that part I don't completely understand, but the one key thing is noise is random, and this is a pattern. So with enough of the right stuff, you can pull patterns out. Now, you can't carry a lot, but anywhere in between. So it's actually in the same signal. It's very practical to be able to send 4K UHD and information targeted for mobile devices. And there are actually tricks that allow you to do that simultaneously with fallback if conditions fail. There's all kinds of flexibility now.
So Ultra HD resolution obviously would need more bits. I assume high dynamic range would need probably more bits.
Well, the interesting thing is adding more dots, going to 4K, costs a lot of bits. Estimated to go from HD to 4K might be about three times as much bandwidth. High dynamic range, maybe 20% more. So the things that are really impactful that people see instantly, high dynamic range, wider color, higher frame rate, are much more efficient than 4K.
I would think higher frame rate wouldn't be.
That surprised me too, but if you step back and think, the encoding takes advantage of similarities between frames. The more frames you have, the less motion between frames. So it's actually
not a factor of two, for example, if you were to double the frame rate.
20%. So it's quite impressive.
Now, one interesting thing I found about this particular demo is that the camera being used, which is a Grass Valley camera, I believe, is not UHD or 4K. It's 1080i even, but high dynamic range.
And what we wanted to emphasize here was not so much more dots, but the impact of high dynamic range.
So the one question left is, well, there are many questions left, but the one question I have for you is, what about the transition? We now have ATSC 1.0, which is in, you know, being received by millions of TVs. 3.0 is coming along. It uses a totally different kind of system. How, are they going to coexist like what happened between analog and digital transition, or how's that going to work?
Yeah, it turns out that's probably one of the most difficult questions. It's more difficult than the actual technical work. But I think there's a solution I've heard that makes a lot of sense. Unlike the original transition, when we first went analog to digital, the broadcasters were given an extra channel to work with so they could send out the old analog system and the new digital system at the same time. And over time, as digital TVs came onto the market, they could make the transition and at the appropriate point turn off the old equipment. Today, there's no extra bandwidth. In fact, there's less. With the auction and the repack, there'll be less bandwidth for broadcasters. So the transition scenario that I've heard, the one that makes the most sense, is for broadcasters to cooperate.
What a concept!
Yeah, but the world has changed. It's appropriate now. And for the simplest example would be two broadcasters in an area to get together. And on one of their transmitters, share the channel, put ATSC 1, the old system, for both of them onto the same transmitter. They may have to reduce service quality a little bit to fit, but they can do it. And on the second transmitter, start broadcasting both in ATSC 3. And that way, the old people with the old televisions, which is most of us, will still watch TV. And those that get the new ones can start receiving ATSC 3. In the interim, there's going to be a number of interesting devices that appear called gateway devices. And these are devices that have antennas, they have tuners, they may have transcoders, and they also have Wi-Fi or wired Ethernet connections. And what they'll do is take the ATSC 3 new transmission, receive it, not decode it, but demodulate it, and put it onto the Wi-Fi network or the wired network in the home, and existing devices can start receiving it. So that Wi-Fi signal can be picked up by a smartphone, a tablet. In many cases, the tablet you have in your hand or the cell phone, smartphone in your pocket will be able to receive what these gateway devices put out today with no change. It's very conceivable that very cheap add-on devices, HDMI dongles as an example, or the next generation of Roku or Amazon or whatever, will have the capability to deal with this. And all the people with ATSC 1 or today's systems very inexpensively will be able to receive ATSC 3. So I think there's actually a very viable transition path that allows people to continue to watch TV and be able to pick up the new stuff. And there's even some thoughts on how to bring new capabilities to the old TVs, which are very enlightening, but I'm not going to say much about that yet.
Well, these are exciting times for sure. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Here to tell us about the consumer experience of ATSC 3.0 is So Vang, Vice President of Advanced Technology at NAB Pilot, which used to be NAB Labs. It's the R&D arm of NAB, right?
That's correct, yes.
So we just had a really good deep dive into the technology of ATSC 3.0 and how it gets transmitted, but what is the user experience going to be like?
Right. So probably the best way to do it is to kind of show you, kind of go through a little bit of this. So what we have done is we have built what we call the Pilot Home Gateway. And our focus is on the interactive runtime environment. And that is one of the new features of ATSC 3 that really focuses on the user experience. So let me take you through a couple of these. For example, the interactive runtime environment is purely based on web standards. And as you can see here, we actually have developed some applications using that platform. So a typical applications that would provide by a broadcaster is the weather. And in this particular case, we're showing the weather for the week, and we shrink the video to the upper right corner.
And this can be done with over-the-air transmitted signals.
That's correct. This is all about broadcast TVs. And certainly with 3.0, we have the advantage of also utilizing the broadband, but our focus is that it should work, the two should work together. Another example of a service here is on-demand. This is something that you see with over-the-top services, but 3.0 actually enabled this type of capability or services for broadcasters as well. So, some additional ones are like interactive news, for example. We work with MPG to put this application together. And here we're showing on-demand news. So these are assets that local broadcasters already have. But 3.0 actually provides a convenient tool for them to make these assets easily accessible to the viewers. So, for example, here we're clicking on the on-demand, and as you can see, we have a full library of local content, and we can just pick one. This is sort of campaign time, so let's pick this one. So here you go, right?
If someone wanted to learn what's latest in the campaign, they could just click on that and see it.
That's exactly right. That's why it's news on demand. Right, right.
Now, what we're seeing here is actually being served from a server because you don't actually have an RF receiver chip in these boxes yet.
That's correct. But we hope that will change very soon here.
Yeah. At the moment, it's still under development, and the standards are mostly done, right?
Well, certainly we're making a lot of progress on the hardware, the physical layer. Yeah, so you're going to see a lot more demonstration of that here. And on the upper layer, the interactive runtime environment, we're making a lot of progress there as well. This is the reason why we have been able to develop this prototype very quickly and demo here.
Yeah. When do you think consumers will actually be able to have this in their home? What's the time frame are we looking at here?
Now, you put me on the spot for that one.
I'm not going to hold you to it. But, I mean, are we talking 1 year, 2 years, 3 years?
Well, certainly the Koreans are, I believe they're expected to deploy in 2018. I would expect that by around that time or later that year, we should start to have, you know, some trials. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. At least that may be a little bit aggressive, but that would be ideal.
I think the standards are expected to be completed maybe by the end of this year, reach final standard state.
I would say that probably a large number of the specs will be done by the end of this year. Yeah.
And then, of course, you got to get the broadcasters and the equipment manufacturers and everybody to build the stuff and work together to make sure it all works, right?
That's right, yeah.
So we're talking, you said 2018, right? So we're talking a couple years.
Yeah, I would say realistically, yeah. For the whole end-to-end, you know, I would say that's probably a realistic date, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you talk to the transition? How is it going to work? When we transition to digital video to begin with, digital broadcasting, they existed in parallel with analog broadcasting. Is the same thing going to happen here, 1.0 and 3.0 existing in parallel?
Well, that certainly is one way that broadcasters could transition to 3.0. But I couldn't possibly, comment on that at this point. I'm sure that there are multiple ways that we can transition to it. But, you know, I'm a technology guy. My goal is to show what's possible.
Yeah. Well, and what's possible here is pretty impressive. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Fraunhofer IIS has been working on a technology called light field photography. And here to tell us about it is Frederick Zilli, the group manager, one of the group managers, I'm sure there are many. Tell us about what light field technology is in the broadest sense, and then what's the latest news that you have here at NAB?
Okay, so with light field, you try to capture all light rays which pass through a certain surface. So you can imagine if you look through a window, and if you are able to capture all light rays which go through that window, then you are able to reproduce them. And this means that if you look at the window and you move your head left and right, that you can look behind objects. This is our definition of light fields.
And so what that lets you do, you need to capture, when you're capturing it on a camera, you're actually using an array of cameras, right?
Yes, that's correct. So we need to capture different angles, different perspective of the same scene. And our approach is to do that using multiple cameras. This can be 15 cameras, 20 cameras. This is a low number of cameras compared to other approaches, but we think this is a more practical approach for the film set.
And what that means then is once you have that data, you can change things about the image, the focus, the direction you're looking from, so on.
Exactly. So when we have all the light rays, we can create virtual views. So we interpolate views. We can move the camera virtually in X, Y, and Z space. And we can create synthetic apertures. So this means we can render a bokeh. So you can have a circular bokeh. You can change the depth of field. You can create a shallow depth of field or the inverse later in post-production.
Is this being used in any commercial endeavors yet, or is it still experimental?
So we have done some test productions together with Stuttgart Media University, where we had created a short film called Coming Home. So it was with a real actor, real camera system, and so it was a real 2 minutes clip. Yeah.
And so here at the show 2016, you're showing some developments in this way for content creators, right?
That's correct. So we have analyzed how we can integrate light field post-production into existing post-production workflows. And we came up that integrating this is easy when you offer them plugins. And Nuke is a compositing software which is widely used and which has a good support for multi-camera data. And this is why we offer here a plugin suite for Nuke, which is able to process multi-camera data and turns this into a dense light field with all the visual effects which you want.
Yeah, and so the person who's using this system can then do all those things we talked about earlier and create the image that they want to create.
Exactly. So you start by importing the footage, and then you add different nodes and connect them to existing compositions, and then you have a very precise access to all images, to all views of all cameras, and you can manipulate all the images. You have an interactive feedback. You can see the depth maps, and then create the effects you wanted.
With 16 or 20 or 24 or some number of cameras, that's an awful lot of data.
This is correct, yes. But it is small compared to other approaches, yes? So on the other hand, of course, you need a sophisticated recording system, but this is possible today. So what is good for us is that multi-camera and capturing multi-camera is now a more and more common task because we are entering, there's a growing demand for multi-camera data, also in context of virtual reality productions, of course. So today you can get synchronized multi-cameras. There are recording possibilities for multi-cameras. So this is something which can be done today, yes?
And in fact, you have a very interesting multi-camera rig over there called the OmniCam 360, which we're going to go take a look at next.
Yes, this is from our partner institute in Berlin. And in fact, they have different solutions for panoramic capturing.
And this is not light field, by the way.
No, this is not light field. So this is for panorama 3D. And here our approach is to generate real parallax, that you can create content where you can look behind objects. Mm-hmm. So,
sort of like 3D, but without the glasses.
It can be 3D, of course. Glasses means it depends on the application. So one application is you create visual effects for a 2D movie. Another application is you could create content for head-mounted displays. Then you have glasses again, but other kind of glasses.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
As we're here in the Fraunhofer booth, we ran across this really interesting thing called the OmniCam 360. And here to tell us about it is Peter Kauf, head of department for the visual and imaging department, at Fraunhofer Heinrich Hertz Institute in Berlin. Yes. What in the world is this?
Okay, so that is our Omnicam 360. That is a product we already have since around about 2 years, and it is for a recording panoramic videos in 360 with extremely high quality. And the idea is to use such a mirror to get the panoramic video with high quality in real time, because the mirror helps for the stitching process. The stitching process is a process by which you have to bring these 10 cameras. We have 10 HD cameras here, these 10 cameras together seamlessly to one full 360 panoramic view.
Now, this obviously would be for virtual reality applications.
So at the moment, I think, of course, virtual reality applications with all this VR goggles is one market for it. But originally, we also thought about large screen cinemas with 180 degree, for instance. But we have our own cinema at our labs for that. But also for moving at an or navigating in a 360 video at a tablet, for instance. Not only VR, but VR is, of course, one of the main applications at the moment because of this hype in VR.
So people are actually using this camera now that it's been out for a couple of years?
Absolutely. So we have a lot of productions, professional productions done with it during the last 2 years. It's so one of the most popular one or famous ones for us, or prominent ones for us, was the final championship game of the FIFA soccer championship in Rio de Janeiro. So we are Germany won against...
Yay!
That's it, yeah. But we are also working with the Berlin Philharmonics, for instance, and did a lot of recordings for rock concerts. For instance, Bon Jovi in Australia. Australia for... yeah, and many else. Yeah. So.
Well, it's a really interesting looking thing, and I can't wait to see the result. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you very much. You're welcome.
Before we continue, I'd like to take a moment to thank one of our sponsors for this episode, which is CuriosityStream, the world's first ad-free non-fiction streaming service. Founded by John Hendricks, the founder of Discovery Communication, CuriosityStream offers over 1,400 titles and 600 hours of content. It's available in 196 countries worldwide, and they're available on many platforms, web apps, Roku, Android, iOS, Chromecast, Amazon Fire, Amazon Kindle, and Apple TV. There's a wide variety of science and technology content, plus nature, history, and many more topics. There are over 50 hours of 4K content, which they've just launched. In fact, it's one of the largest 4K libraries on the Internet. In addition to documentaries, they also have interviews and lectures. Their library includes Stephen Hawking's Universe, a series where Stephen Hawking traces the history of astronomical theories and technology. Next World, featuring Michio Kaku talking about the future of technology, virtual reality, artificial intelligence, and other big technological questions. The Human Face of Big Data, currently exclusively on CuriosityStream, and The Road to the Singularity. Jason Silva and other experts explore the inevitable arrival of superhuman intelligence in this CuriosityStream original documentary. Monthly and annual plans are available, and plans start at just $2.99 per month, less than a cup of coffee, or the cost of one title on competing on-demand platforms. Check out CuriosityStream.com/twit and use the promo code TWIT during sign-up to get unlimited access to the world's top documentaries and non-fiction series, completely free for the first 60 days. That's two entire months free of one of the largest 4K libraries around. Just go to CuriosityStream.com/TWIT and use the offer code TWIT at sign up. Here in the Dolby booth, I'm talking with Jeffrey Reedmiller, VP of the sound group of the office of the CTO of Dolby. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having us.
Also, Roland Vlaiku, VP of consumer imaging, I believe, is your title.
That's right. Good
close enough?
Absolutely. Good to see you, Scott.
So both of you are involved in this ATSC demonstration that we're having here, the first live broadcast of ATSC 3.0 in the world. And first of all, Jeffrey, tell us about the audio portion of that. You're using AC4, which is your latest audio codec.
Yes, AC4 is our latest audio codec. I'm working on it for about 4 years. It's been, we're leading kind of a lot of standards efforts around the world, including ATSC. We're currently in the balloting process to become candidate standard. And we're, you know, getting this out to the market, both on the professional side and the consumer side. We're showing a couple televisions here with AC4 natively in it. We expect these televisions to be in market the beginning of 2017. So we're excited about the momentum for AC4.
Now, AC4 is object-oriented, I believe, and includes the ability to choose different audio streams, say which commentator you want to listen to in a sports cast, that sort of thing?
Yes, yes. So it's all about, you know, there's kind of a handful of pillars we think about when we think about the experiences AC4 can deliver. One is personalization, as you talked about, giving, you know, your native speaking, non-native speaking audience some choice on, let's say, the level of dialogue, choosing different languages, descriptions, things like that. In the past, in the previous system, the ATSC1 system and legacy broadcast, you know, the non-native speaking audience only got to listen to stereo or even mono most of the time. And now we're going to be able to expand the experience for everybody. And that's really, really key. And that's what's got a lot of people excited.
And can you also do immersive audio like Atmos?
Yes, of course. Atmos, we've been hard at work on that from the cinema, bringing that to the home over the past several years. And AC4 is poised to deliver object-based audio or immersive audio in channel kind of based variants and object-based variants too, to kind of meet, to be as flexible as we can be across broadcast workflows. Yep, yep.
Now, Roland, you're also involved with Dolby Vision, the high dynamic range system that Dolby has developed in this demonstration, right?
Yes, so what we've done is we're showing the live workflow for live sports events, etc., using the SMPTE 2084 standard that is using the perceptual quantization EOTF.
EOTF is electro-optical transfer function. It's the way the TV responds to brightness signals, brightness values in the signal.
Exactly, and up to date, the world has been using gamma, which was great for standard dynamic range, but doesn't really work for high dynamic range, so we developed a new concept here that we've standardized in SMPTE, and that is the underlying baseline for this demonstration, as well as, of course, for Dolby Vision.
Right, and so what I found interesting was that the camera that's capturing the image that's being broadcast is high dynamic range. It's capturing high dynamic range with, I guess, the PQ curve, and then that is being translated all the way to the end of the line, which is the TVs that we're going to go see very shortly here, which implement Dolby Vision.
That's right. So we have, as I said, developed an entire workflow where on the production side, all you do is replace the existing standard dynamic range signal with this PQ signal, you know, the same bit 10-bit container that travels all the way through the plant and gives you HDR instead of SDR. And, of course, you still need the SDR standard dynamic range signal as well, which we can derive in real time at a very high quality from the PQ signal that is captured.
Yeah, that was my next question was, what about all those people that don't have a high dynamic range set? The standard dynamic range can be extracted or derived from the Dolby Vision signal without any trouble at all.
That's right. So there's a real-time algorithm that we're showing here and also in the ATSC booth where this is happening and arguably at a higher quality because we capture at a high quality. We leverage the entire range of the sensor in the camera. Today, what you get in a broadcast camera is a down-mapped version from the sensor range down to the standard dynamic range output. We worked with the camera manufacturers to open that up and represent it as PQ, SMPTE 2084, and send that through the chain. And yes, you can derive at any point in time, whether you need it for monitoring or for your legacy distribution paths, a very high-quality standard dynamic range version.
Now, AC4 isn't yet officially adopted within the ATSC specification, right? You're in the process of, I guess it's called candidate process?
Yes, it's in the balloting phase going to candidate standard status. And the candidate standard status will give everybody involved in ATSC3 a chance to actually what we call kind of kick the tires in the technology as it's become going through the process. The stage beyond candidate standard is proposed standard, and beyond that it's full standard. So this is just another step in the progression to full standardization. Yep.
What about Dolby Vision? Is that also in the candidate standard phase? How is that going to be incorporated within ATSC?
So the timeline for imaging technologies is slightly different, so it's still early days. Of course, as the industry has recognized, HDR is an important topic. ATSC has recognized that as well. And now we're working along with others on identifying the right use cases and then consequently what the right technology solutions are to those cases.
Does Dolby Vision, does there need to be some special coding for Dolby Vision to be passed through the ATSC infrastructure to get to the TV, or can it be something else and then the TV implements Dolby Vision at the end to render the high dynamic range?
Right, so of course you need to capture high dynamic range signal, and this to begin with. There are many ways to deliver Dolby Vision, single layer, non-backward compatible, dual layer, backward compatible. We also add dynamic metadata, which we add at the head end, to the PQ signal. So we are showing flexible solutions where you capture PQ, don't need any metadata in production, all the way to the head end, and at the head end generates the real-time dynamic metadata, which then makes the signal Dolby Vision, which then makes it compatible with the Dolby Vision TVs in the market.
Exciting times, aren't they?
Oh yes, yes. We're busy, but we're excited. We're really excited.
I am too. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Scott.
Here we are in the ATSC 3.0 Consumer Experience booth at the far other end of the hall from the production facility where we were earlier, quarter mile away. And I'm talking with Mark Richer, president of the Advanced Television Systems Committee, ATSC, for which this whole thing is named. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So what are we seeing here in the consumer experience?
Well, it's just that. We're trying to give a glimpse of what the different services and products will be for consumers. Back at the other end, a quarter mile away, which used to be a short distance when we were all younger, but now it seems to be getting a little more challenging.
Indeed.
Especially about the third or fourth time you do it during the show. That's all about the broadcast solutions and things that broadcast engineers and people having to make capital purchases and figure out how to do things. That's all about that. This is about what does it mean to the consumer. And this is just a little glimpse of what will be possible, but it's just to give you a flavor of what ATSC 3.0 can do.
Now, we've seen some examples already of interactivity, being able to choose different pieces of content, video on demand, news on demand, getting the weather whenever you want, that sort of thing, choosing different audio streams, which announcer do you want to listen to, that sort of thing. So you're demonstrating all of that right here.
We are, and but again, it's more from the consumer standpoint. So we have great demos showing the ability to customize the audio, personalize the audio, such as being able to raise the dialogue level compared to the background sound.
Very important application in my home.
Yeah, it's very important both for the people whose hearing might not be what it used to be, as well as for the people who have to tolerate their listening practices with them at home, so they don't just keep turning up the volume, which never fixes the problem, and so the other people become uncomfortable, but doesn't fix the problem. But if you can actually change the level of the dialogue compared to the background sound or the music, then it helps to mitigate the problem. So we have those demos here. We have demos of in the audio area, some immersive sound, which is obviously very, very important to the future of television, but also, again, more personalization in terms of making it easy to switch to different languages. Have the TV automatically switch to the language that is your preferred language. So if something happens to be in another language, the TV will do that automatically based on your profile. There's even a great thing. One of the things I love in here, and I really recommend you take a listen to it, they show during a rugby match, and they show how you could switch to an audio channel that's a comedy audio channel where the comedian is basically announcing it as if he's seeing this for the first time. He doesn't know any of the rules of the game, doesn't know what they're trying to do. He's just looking at the people massing up and doing various things. Uh-huh. So I really recommend you do that. It's kind of fun. And again, it shows the different kinds of capabilities of ATSC 3.0.
Now, there are several TVs here with ATSC 3.0 receiver chips in them.
Absolutely.
This is a prototypical situation, though. We don't really have TVs yet with those chips in them, right?
Well, they're not on the market yet, but these are moving close. These are chips that the first one is done by LG. So if you see some of the TVs around here, they actually have the chip built in, and that's great news. The Korea market, as you might know, is going to probably push ahead more quickly with ATSC 3.0, focused on over-the-air 4K UHD TV. And they are aiming to have a service on by 2018, no later than 2018 for the Olympics in Seoul. So that's very exciting, and that will help drive the market. There's other devices besides the televisions, and that's one thing that I think is going to differentiate, one of the many things that differentiates ATSC 3.0 from the first version of ATSC, is that we're going to have different devices that aren't televisions or big clunky converters. We're going to have one group here calls it a broadcast antenna, some call it a broadcast gateway, where the device receives the ATSC 3.0 broadcast signal off the air. It may or may not store it, but it will put it out on the home network, on Wi-Fi or Ethernet. So you not only can receive display it on your television through Wi-Fi, but your phones, your tablets, any kind of device in the home, and you're going to get it the way you get other content. It's just, over the home network. It's just that will have been delivered by broadcast, which is an efficient way to deliver certain kinds of content. So we're very excited about those kinds of products, and it changes your thinking about how a transition might work. There'll be other kinds of converters too, probably dongles that fit into an HDMI port or a USB port. Those are exciting. So there's just plenty of stuff here to see.
You mentioned the transition, and I'm recalling back in the days when we went from analog to digital, to ATSC 1.0, and there were parallel streams going at the same time. You had analog on for a while, digital on for a while. Rich Chernock at Triveni said you can't really do that this time because there isn't enough bandwidth. There isn't a lot of the spectrum has been sold off.
It's going to be a little more challenging, but the technology, I think, provides a lot of new opportunities. It's going to be a real market-driven approach, I think, less government-driven. But I think everybody will benefit from it. And if broadcasters are creative, they'll be able to move forward with ATSC 3.0. And it's important because television broadcasting needs to move forward with technology just like every other industry. It's not a 50-year standard anymore. That just doesn't make sense. If the technology we have in ATSC is great, it's 25 years old. I mean, the MPEG-2 technology that's built into it is 25 years old. So you need to move on with new technology. And that's what we've done here. It's the most powerful, most robust broadcast system there is. It's the first system and only system that's based upon Internet Protocol, IP, as a backbone instead of an MPEG transport. And that provides all kinds of advantages in terms of services and products and development and all of that. One other thing I'd like to bring your attention to in terms of demos here is we have our AWARN demo, which is advanced warning technology. And this shows how the new standard has a lot of features built into it that will enable delivery of content to emergency service providers and to the public in times of natural or man-made disasters. Something that we have to work on these days and really focus on. Very important part of broadcasting is providing content to people in a given market when there are these disasters. There's a lot of different applications of that, including the ability, if the consumer selects the option, to have a TV or device turn on automatically. So if it's in the middle of the night and you don't have your TV on, it'll turn on and give you the emergency information about a tornado or hurricane or fire or whatever it is. So we think this is also critically important, and we've spent a lot of time building that technology in, and you can see that here at the consumer experience.
So when do we expect full deployment? Is there any way to predict that?
Well, it's always hard to predict that. Of course, our focus is on getting the standards completely done.
And how long will that take?
Well, ATSC 3.0 is really a suite of standards. It's not one standard. So there's about 20 different parts of it, 20 different pieces. And some of them are one of them's done now, the lowest level of the physical layer. The second part of the physical layer will be done in about a month or 6 weeks. And then the other pieces will fall in place. We hope to be completely done by the end of 2016 or probably the beginning of 2017. And that's the schedule we said we would be on 4.5 years ago, and we're still on it.
That's remarkable in and of itself.
Yeah, we're really proud of it, and I'm just amazed at the level of collaboration from people around the globe, engineers and scientists who have been working full-time on these different technologies, implementing them, modeling them, testing them, doing peer review of different technologies. It's really been great, and the level of cooperation just makes it all fun for me.
I'm sure it does, and it's fun for everybody else who sees all these demos. It's a remarkable achievement. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Great to see you.
Hey, I'm here at the SMPTE booth, and I'm talking with Howard Luck, newly appointed Director of Engineering and Standards. Now, Howard, there's a lot of work going on in standards now. We've got high dynamic range, and there's something new in high dynamic range that I heard about just recently, SMPTE 2094, is that right?
Yeah, I think that's the right number. Now, there's so many numbers I get confused sometimes, so don't hold me to this. But 2094, which has to do with dynamic metadata for HDR. So we have the PQ, which has been codified with 2084. We have 2986, I think it is, which is the static metadata.
Right.
And now, to incorporate other types of HDR systems, we have the dynamic metadata, which is coming through. It's a couple of parts in that series, so there's many different parts of the series that are coming up. But it allows people to send scene-by-scene changes for HDR down to the final destination, and that's the goal of the dynamic metadata.
Right. Now, Dolby Vision, that's sort of the basis of Dolby Vision, and now you're adding it to the SMPTE open standard, which I think will give the SMPTE standard a lot more flexibility.
Yeah, absolutely. So this allows a lot more flexibility to actually get all the way through the product change, system change, out to the final destination. So it'll get a lot more flexibility for the monitors to actually reproduce with different types of luminance levels, scenes, all those kind of things that go on, like we do in creativity land. So,
right. Well, this is one of the big problems with HDR, isn't it? That in SDR land, we knew exactly what the peak luminance was. We knew what the color gamut was of any display that was properly calibrated.
Right, right.
But now we don't, because the HDR displays have different luminance, peak luminances, different color gamuts, and somehow that has to be taken care of.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the old days, we just fixed everything as a static thing. And that was written down in the Bible and the stones. And then we went about and did our business, and it worked very well.
Moses came down from the mountain with
tablet was empty, just carved it into the stones, and we went along our business.
Right.
Now, of course, you've got different creatives wanting to do different things. You've got displays that are much different. I mean, we're way past the CRT, so we've got all types of different technology and display devices, so they have different color gamuts, can handle different luminances. And on the creativity side, people want to use different luminances for the content. So 1,000 nits versus 400 nits versus 2,000 nits versus 4,000 nits. Now, how do we send that through the food chain, basically?
Right.
And so this is why you need metadata accompanying that stuff, to let the display do the right thing at the very end of the device, so content creators, like myself as a hobby, can be assured that it looks like the way we intended it to look at the end device.
And that's really what SMPTE is all about, isn't it? Is preserving the content creator's intent.
Right, absolutely, absolutely. We do everything we can to make sure that that can be carried through the whole food chain.
Yeah. Anything else going on in standards that you can talk about?
So there's a lot of, in the broadcast side of the world, a lot of people that are getting video over IP. And so there's a lot of work that's being done right now. You probably heard of the Aspen and the AIMS and the different profiles that are going along. We're trying to get a consensus among that and get that moving along too. Because as you know, the broadcast world is turning into fully IP facilities at some point in time. So SDI is a little long in the tooth. It's done a very, very good job. But now,
SDI, by the way, is just the secure digital interface.
Well, no, it's serial digital interface.
Serial digital interface, which is a wire that goes from one device to another. Now, we have IP, which also uses a wire typically, but could also be wireless, but probably not in the production environment.
Right, right. So in SDI land, we have to specifically connect wires to get from source to destination. And in IP world, basically you give an address, send it out, and it finds its way to its destination. So it's a little bit of a different technology. It works very, very well for the web and the internet, of course, that everybody knows. But in the broadcast world, we really haven't lived that way for a while. And, of course, there's things that timing, synchronization that are very, very critical. You want to push a button and make it show up on the screen, right? So these are the things that we work through in SMPTE to make sure that we have a really good, solid standard for the broadcasters as well.
And it's also important because ATSC 3.0 is based on IP.
Exactly. It's going all IP as well over the air. So now the whole world is kind of shifted over to an IP network system. So SMPTE's moved to that direction. So a lot more software standards, a lot more IP-centric type of a device these days.
It's an exciting time. Thanks so much.
Absolutely is. You're welcome.
Before we continue, I'd like to thank our other sponsor for this episode, which is Epson. Epson's revolutionary EcoTank line of printers for home and office introduce a new age in printing. The new EcoTank ET4550 wireless all-in-one printer doesn't use ink cartridges. Instead, it features an innovative refillable ink tank. It comes with enough ink to print up to 11,000 black pages or 8,500 color pages, equivalent to about 50 ink cartridge sets. You're loaded and ready to print for up to 2 years. Powered by Epson's leading-edge precision core technology, it delivers high-speed, vivid colors, and laser-quality black text. Plus, auto two-sided printing, a 30-page auto document feeder, and easy wireless printing from tablets and smartphones. It's no wonder the ET4550 printer was named a CES 2016 Innovation Awards honoree. All EcoTank printers deliver an unbeatable combination of convenience and value with ultra-low-cost replacement ink bottles. Now you have the freedom to print without running out of ink. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank today to transform the way your home, office, or work group prints. For the best combination of ease and value, turn to the new Epson EcoTank printers. That's EPSON.com/EcoTank. And we thank Epson very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks. Epson, exceed your vision. I'm here with Rich Welsh, CEO of Sundog, and you're also the chairman of the Future of Cinema conference that happened just before the NAB show, and what a conference it was, man. Lots of really interesting stuff.
Yeah, it was pretty special. I think we were very excited about the speakers we had, the program we had, and we had some genuinely historic moments in the conference. So the two standout elements were the pre-launch, I guess, of the new Lytro light field camera, which is an incredible piece of technology, generating a 750 megapixel image, which then allows you to use computational photography to manipulate the scene and do lots of things that just aren't possible with a kind of traditional camera and lens. And it was amazing to have that launched at the show. But the other thing that really everybody is still buzzing about was Ang Lee giving a keynote, which was inspirational, and showing content from his new movie, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, which has been filmed and was shown here exclusively in 120 frames per second per eye 3D at 4K on a laser projector at 28-foot Lambert's brightness. If 3D is spectacular, just an unbelievable experience for everyone who got to see that.
Yeah, which I did, and I felt very fortunate to, because it was an unbelievable cinematic experience. There were a few people who again started complaining that it wasn't film-like, that it wasn't cinema-like, because it was shot at such a high frame rate. You know, we've had 24 frames per second for the last 100 years. And I agree, it didn't look like any movie I had ever seen before. I didn't care. I was happy that we have finally transcended this limitation that was only put in place because of the limitations of the time almost 100 years ago.
Absolutely, and I think it is a challenge. We are used to 24 frames per second, but what we're used to are all the failings of it. You know, the motion judder, the resolution that you can achieve with that lower frame rate. And actually, you're right. This does not look like cinema as we know it, but it is not meant to. You know, this is a genuine paradigm shift. This is going into the place where we can go with image, and it takes the audience with it. The format takes the audience there. We had, almost everybody I talked to said that after a while, and they, you know, there was a jar when they first started watching it, that it didn't feel like cinema. It's on a cinema screen. It looks like a cinema picture.
Looks like a movie.
It looks like a movie picture, but then because of the frame rate, because of that and the resolution, it doesn't feel right somehow. But very quickly, you get used to that, and the next thing that happens is you start getting drawn in, like it or not, to the picture. And the experience is, it's a physical experience. Yeah. The particular sequence was a battle scene in Iraq, and it made you shake. It made your heart rate go up. this is very different to anything we've seen in the cinema before. I genuinely believe, having seen that and having heard the feedback from people, it was an incredibly positive thing, their experience of it. But it did shake them. And this is going to do something for you.
Ang Lee, in his keynote, did mention that he thought that the increased frame rate, increased brightness, actually increased the emotional response of the audience. And I felt that myself.
Absolutely. I think that's what everyone left with, having, you know, even though it was only a 10-minute sequence, more or less 12 minutes, people came out of there having been moved emotionally. Even if it's not their kind of movie, you know, the story is always at the core of these things, and that doesn't change. But the way in which you can now put that story in front of the audience, this in this format, is significantly different. And I think we've got so much to learn about it, so much to learn. And Ang Lee said that himself. He doesn't know anything, is what he said. I don't know anything. My team don't know anything. He said
we're having to relearn how to make movies.
Yeah, no makeup anymore because you can see it. You know, props have to be perfect because you can see when they're not. Costumes. You can't light the scene because you can see it's been lit. Everything changes about how we make a movie. We've got to rethink the entire art. Even the acting has to change. It's crazy.
It was astonishing. I can't wait to see it. Unfortunately, no theater in the world yet can show it at 4K, 3D, 120 frames per second. The projectors that they were using were not digital cinema projectors because they don't have the security that the movie studios require. And the best that we can get in the movie studios and the movie theaters is, I think he said 2K, at 3D at 60 frames per second with one projector, or 120 with two projectors.
That's right, and clearly this format is pushing the, you know, pushing the art on so much that we are actually ahead of the curve in terms of the general cinema. But I think there is a possibility of special venues where maybe one in each major city could show this in that format. You can get around the security by having protection if you're going to do that. You know, if you're not shipping the movie around everywhere it unprotected, you're going to do it in special venues. There is a chance, and I really, really hope that happens, that we get an opportunity for audiences to go and experience it, even if it's for 2 weeks in major cities and only a relatively small amount of people see it. We need people to experience this, because we were very privileged to have the 600 some people who got to see it this weekend here. But, you know, we're a kind of a small group of engineers at an engineering show. And, you know, what we want is that just the general public get to see this.
I want that, too. I really want people to see this, and I hope they get a chance to. Now, the last thing I wanted to mention was that you're also in charge of what's called the HPA Tech Retreat in the UK. It's been held here in California for many years, but you're bringing it now over to the UK.
Yes, that's right. It's a great event that happens every February in Palm Springs. It's a sellout show every time. It's a whole week, actually, of program. And we wanted to bring that to the UK. The show is a little bit shorter. We have 3 days of programming. It's the first time. We want to make sure that we deliver something that the audience can grow to love, and then we want to do this every year. So the program this year, we're going to really go into some great new content. We have a Game of Thrones production team coming along. They're going to be telling us all about season 6 and the post-production on that, which has just finished shooting, so this is hot off the press content. And then we're building around that a program looking at all the latest stuff in terms of high frame rate, high dynamic range. We have a great exhibition area for new technology. It's a curated exhibition zone. It's not a trade show. It's specially to show our audience new cutting-edge things. And the theme really this year is about ultra everything. So, you know, it's high frame rate, it's high dynamic range, it's high resolution, it's wide color gamut, you know, it's 3D, it's spatial audio. So, yeah, we want to look at all these new things, virtual reality as well. You know, this new experience that the audience is now getting, the consumer can get their hands on, and that is going to be commonplace quite soon. And we have to figure out how we make stuff for this. Mm-hmm. So we're going to really build a program around that, and hopefully this is something the UK audience will really love. And it's very much focused on Hollywood content that is produced and post-produced in the UK. We have a very rich production community there, on such as Game of Thrones, other big movies like Star Wars, and all the BBC content. And so, you know, we have loads of really great stuff, and even Netflix are shooting stuff now in the UK. So,
and when is this event going to happen?
Okay, so it's July 12th to 14th. It's up in Oxfordshire, about an hour and a half out of London, at Heathrop Park, which is a beautiful 18th century manor house. It's a great conference venue. It's going to be in the summer, so fingers crossed the weather will be okay. Won't be Las Vegas, but it'll be all right. Yeah. We just encourage people to go and have a look on the HPA website or on the SMPTE website, find out about it, register now for the early bird rate, and get up to Oxfordshire and learn some new stuff about the future of media.
Sounds great. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm in the Christie booth, and I'm fortunate enough to be with two Christie representatives who are going to help us understand what's happening here in the booth. First of all,
I'm Jeevan Vivekananthan, Senior Director of Product Management.
And you're managing the products that are non-cinematic, that is, the projectors that don't go into commercial cinemas.
Yeah, that's right. So we at Christie, we have a full range of cinematic lineup products, but image processing and displays, and in fact what we're showing here on HDR, are all our non-cinema versions.
And I'm also here with
Mike Perkins, Principal Product Developer.
And you're more on the deep technical end of things here, right?
Yeah, correct. I do the system design of the whole projection systems.
A very important job, I should say. Let's start with you. You're showing, highlighting here, HDR, high dynamic range, which Christie already does with Dolby Vision, but this is something different, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So we have the Dolby Vision systems, but what we really wanted to show here is that there's a professional venue application for this. So what we're showing is applications in things like large scale experiences where people want like this ultimate phenomenal contrast ratio, super bright, super dark, darks. It makes any sort of non-cinematic viewing experience really outstanding, and that's what we're showing in our theater today.
So what kind of venues would these projectors be found in?
A variety of different things. So you can use these kinds of projectors in things like a planetarium might need a super high contrast ratio. At a theme park, a dark ride might benefit from a very high contrast ratio. You know, lots of visual punch, super bright colors, and really the glints of all the reflections off objects, as well as these super black blacks to really create that immersive experience. So anything that's got a really large scale sort of oomph factor, typically like these big bright entertainment venues.
So give us the specs on what we're seeing in here in terms of peak brightness and so on.
Sure. It's a 4K resolution projector with a Rec 2020 color space. It's 9,000 lumens on a 16-foot screen, which gives us about 200 nits, or if you prefer, 56-foot Lamberts.
200 nits, 56-foot Lamberts in a commercial-sized system. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. And
that's not even as high as you can go, is it?
No, it uses our laser technology, which is scalable. If we put a full rack of lasers in there, we could be well north of 20,000 lumens.
And what about the black level? I mean, you probably get down to pretty close to zero, don't you?
Absolutely. We're well in excess of a 1,000,000-to-1 contrast ratio. So when we turn out the show a flat field black, you can't see a single thing in the theater.
Well, I've noticed this in Dolby Vision cinema, where I go as much as I can to see it because it's so amazing.
Yeah.
When you get to a black interstitial, you can't see anything. The screen disappears.
Every time I've sat with people and go through the demo, the images look amazing, and then that first time that you get that full fade to black, and we have a fully blacked out theater just to sort of show that off, people are like, oh my God, it's like a black hole. It sucked out all the light out of the room.
Yeah.
Really phenomenal.
Really phenomenal. You probably don't have any exit signs in there either. That becomes a problem with high dynamic range, doesn't it?
Absolutely. So when you design a venue for HDR, there's going to have to be a lot of thought and planning on how you handle exit signs and emergency lighting and the little lights that they always put on the aisles in theaters. But with careful planning and forethought, it can be dealt with and managed.
So we're seeing in here one projector, right?
Yeah, it's a 2D system we're showing here. The technology is scalable to 3D, but what we really wanted to show is that in HDR, the 2D effect actually is really powerful and amazing. You don't need to add 3D, I think, to really to make it a compelling experience.
I have to agree. AMC, which has deployed Dolby Vision in some of their theaters, has decided, for the most part, not to do 3D. And I think that was the right decision, you know, because the HDR is so dimensional as it is. And to tell you the truth, I don't particularly like 6P 3D, which is the way they do it there, with slightly different red, green, and blue for each eye, because the glasses and my glasses interact in an unpleasant way. Although I have to say, for the first time, I did not experience that with the Ang Lee demonstration. You must have seen the Ang Lee demonstration during the Future of Cinema conference.
In fact, Mike was the one who helped set that up and so on. And so, yeah, that was an amazing thing. High frame rate, 120 hertz per eye, an amazing experience. And but those that 6P laser system that Christy's got, that makes that 3D experience really that much better, that left right eye primary separation. You got a really compelling 3D experience, and most people, and that frame rate in addition, it really, I heard a lot of people walking out of the theater saying that that was the best 3D they had ever seen.
Well, I have to say it was for me too, and I did not get the problems with this what I call internal reflections between my glasses and the 3D glasses that I normally get with Dolby 3D. I didn't see it there, and I speculated that it might be because it was so much brighter. It was twice as bright as Dolby 3D and a Dolby Vision Cinema. Do you think that's a reasonable hypothesis?
Certainly that's one half of it is the as you go to higher and higher brightnesses, you know, it's kind of a double-edged sword. It reveals some problems and masks others.
Well, I didn't notice the problems, which include milky halos and some double images and stuff like that, which I've seen in even Dolby Cinema at Dolby's private theater where they have a Dolby Cinema, and they showed The Martian in 3D. Normally, don't get to see Dolby Cinema in 3D, but there I did, and I saw the problem there. And I've seen it in other venues as well, IMAX, which is much lower brightness even so. So getting that super high brightness really made a big difference.
Well, and absolutely, and that's always been a goal of Christie's, is to bring the absolute highest amount of light we can to the projectionist and allow the people who create the content to use that as they see fit.
So when do you think this new system will be deployed?
So what we're showing today is a proof of concept and so on, but because Christie's already developed the base technology, the HDR is Christie, we have a lot of patents, and Mike, in fact, holds many of the patents around this kind of technology. But because we have that, we're developing it now, we expect to have something in the market in by the end of 2017, give or take. We're still working on our development, and we're excited to share it with the market. We wanted to preview it here, just to get people excited of what you can do.
Well, I can't wait to see it myself. Let me ask you one last question. This is not using Dolby Vision, right? This is a Christie proprietary HDR format, right?
That's correct. So the optical architecture is the exact same platform that we worked with Dolby to develop for Dolby Vision, but the electronics and the processing is our own proprietary. And cinema has a certain set of priorities and think careabouts, and the other pro venue have different things that they need to deal with. And so our goal here is to focus on the things that are critical to the non-cinema experience.
Well, I really applaud you for the success of Dolby Vision, but also wish you the best for the success of this system as well.
Thanks very much. We're thrilled to be here, and we want to share it. I just want to add that this will make Mike the absolute killer home theater system, if you can afford it.
Yes, yeah.
Well, this show is called Home Theater Geeks, after all, so if you have the money, and oh, yeah, you're probably not talking money at this point, but certainly in the six figures, I would
get,
yes, a small fortune. If you can afford it, this is the ultimate in home theater. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm here in the SpectraCal booth, which is actually the Portrait Displays booth. I'm with Derek Smith, the CTO of Portrait Displays, formerly SpectraCal. What the heck's going on here?
Well, Scott, we've been talking to Portrait for a number of years about sharing our technologies. And with that, the ability for Calman to be inside of displays has ultimately been my goal. When I formed the corporation, SpectraCal, and then Calman the product 10 years ago, I knew my ultimate goal was to be able to be inside the displays so that everybody could get calibration built in, not have to have separate software, separate interfaces. And the merger with Portrait allows us to get that much closer to it. They work with the display manufacturers over in Asia. We write the calibration software, so it's a really great merger to be able to come along.
Wow, wouldn't that be something to have a TV that you don't need the software or anything? I mean, so the software is great, don't get me wrong, I use it all the time. But if end users, more end users could have a calibrated image, that would be awesome.
Yes, and this is for computers, computer monitors, televisions, projectors. We've been working down that path. There's other manufacturers that have kind of went down that path, but we're, I think, much further ahead on that curve to be able to do it.
Mm-hmm. And Portrait Displays has the contacts and the inroads into those manufacturers to be able to implement this and make it actually happen.
Yes, they've been working with the display manufacturers for about 30 years. If everybody goes back, they got their name from when we had the ability to rotate a display from landscape to portrait.
I remember that.
That was where they got their name from, if you go back to the Radius days and the early Mac. And yeah, so that's where they came from originally.
Wow. And so this happened only the first of this month, huh?
It was 1st of April, yeah. Oh, really? Yeah. Or excuse me, 1st of April.
Yeah, okay.
So yeah, it wasn't an April Fool's joke. We were going to send out press release, but it was like, no, we'll wait about 2 weeks right before NEB to be able to announce it.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Very good. Well, also with us is Joel Barsotti. What is your title now?
They still kept me with the title of Head of Advanced Color Research.
Okay, that's kind of a fun one. Yes, okay, good. What I'm really interested to talk to you about is calibrating for HDR. I mean, that's a difficult thing.
Yeah, it's a really new thing, and with HDR, they kind of turn calibration on its head a little bit, because traditionally, you'd send 100% signal, and you'd calibrate, you know, based on whatever that 100% signal is. Now, you read the peak luminance of the display, and each individual code value has its own specific light output, and so if a display only puts out 100 nits, well, that's about 50% of the PQ signal, so you calibrate up to 50%, and then above 50%, it just clips, and so that's a really new concept to wrap your head around, where you've got an absolute EOTF, each value then representing an absolute luminance value.
Mm-hmm. How is this going to work embedded in displays? I guess it might work better because the embedded software will know what that display's capabilities are.
That is correct, because part of the HDR dilemma is we have to know what the display is capable of. And once we know what the display is capable of, then we can create the proper EOTFs for 2084. We can create the proper roll-offs for the gamuts. But the first step is to know what the display's capabilities are.
Now, you already have a Dolby Vision workflow. Are you developing one for HDR10?
Yeah, we are, and we're working on getting something, and it'll be fairly similar to the Dolby Vision one, because conceptually, they're very similar. You know, the one of the main sort of roadblocks between releasing something right away is kind of, we're still waiting on the standards bodies a little bit, because there's no consumer standards for what we're supposed to do with the metadata and the content, and then how that should map onto the disk, or onto the display from the disk, because, you know, you can go and buy an HDR UHD-enabled Blu-ray today. You can go out to Best Buy and get a player and get a disc and go home and get a display and plug it in, and, you know, we're live now with the stuff. But there's still no standard for how that should actually look when you plug it all in.
Man, it's frustrating, huh?
A little bit.
Joe Kane mentioned the other day that, you know, they had broadcast, DirecTV broadcast the Masters golf tournament in 4K, and they actually inadvertently sent out HDR. But without turning on the flag. And so HDR TV, capable TVs that got it, look totally washed out.
Would, yeah.
Yeah. So I can't wait for those standards to be in place and working. But we're at the very early stages of this whole HDR ecosystem. And I've got great faith in it, but it's not quite there yet, is it?
No, but it's coming along. I mean, the standards for getting the content onto the displays are there. And so the sort of missing component right now is just the ability to evaluate the performance of them to an absolute standard. So, you know, you can look at it and you can go, it looks great. And then you can look at the Samsung and the LG and go, but they look different. They're both similar brightness, but they display it differently, and you don't know which one of them is correct yet. And so with our tools, you can evaluate them and kind of see what they're doing. And you can kind of then take a guess on which one's behaving the way you would expect it to behave and which one may be misbehaving, and then try and make adjustments to try and get them closer to the way you would expect them to behave. It's just right now, like, the gamut roll-off and the tone curve to do the remapping for scenes that are brighter than your display is capable of. are algorithms that are just being left to the display manufacturers, but the general gist of it is there, and the manufacturers are implementing those things. They're just not doing it to a published spec.
Because there is no published spec. Exactly. I assume that you'll still make Cowman software available, even if it's embedded into some TVs.
Yes, we're not abandoning the Cowman roadmap or our products. It's just enhancing where we can put them. So we still have, you know, newer versions of Cowman. In fact, we just had an updated version of Cowman last week, 5.7, which includes a lot of the stuff that Joel's talking about for HLG, HDR10, Dolby Vision. So the whole...
All of that's in 5.7?
Yeah, kind of the whole ecosystem that we've got it all in. And that's based on the latest data that we've got from the standards bodies as they're releasing it. And so there'll probably be additional updates as it's being tweaked as it comes out. But no, our Cowman products are here to stay. This is a great industry for us. It's one of our strongest industries, so we're very passionate about this. So, yeah.
Now, even if it's embedded in a TV, you're still going to need a meter of some sort, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can't do color calibration without some way to quantify what color you're looking at. Yeah. And so that's still always going to require a piece of hardware. But, yeah, the idea would be is, you know, there's solutions now with laptops where they come packaged with calibration software, and you can just plug the puck into the laptop and put it on and then click two buttons and it calibrates. And so the idea is we get to the point where TVs work that way, where you could just, you know, go get your SpectraCal C6, plug it into the LG TV, go into the menu and say calibrate, and then it'll flash its patterns and take its readings, and it'll just magically happen.
Well, I can't wait for that day to happen.
Me too.
And congratulations to both of you on the merger, and best of luck in the future.
All right, thank you very much, Scott.
Thanks, Scott.
Here in the Sony booth, I'm talking with Mike Kovacevic, a sales engineer here at Sony. And Sony's doing a lot with HDR here, and a good thing, too.
Oh, yes. It's been a very, very busy, busy area trying to educate everybody about HDR and the how to acquire and how to get it all the way to home.
So you're basically doing a lens-to-living-room kind of demo here, right?
Absolutely.
So tell us, sort of give us the steps of the process.
So we've got one of our HTC 4300 cameras. Out of the camera, we can output both HD and 4K out of there. So on the displays that we have over here, we have HD, HDR, and we have it in the regular S-Log 3. And then we have S-Log 3 with... the Dolby PQ, the Simpty 2084. It's like, oh, it's
alphabet soup, yeah.
Then we've also got the same signal with HLG applied to it, and then just the regular 709, but in a 400 nit display. Then we have the 4K in HDR wide color, the 2020 color space.
True 2020?
Pretty damn close.
Okay.
There's been some funny stories about people that have actually seen true 2020, and they've only lasted maybe 20, 30 minutes.
Really? Why is that?
It's been laser-based, yeah. And it's been very, very prototype. So it's, yes.
Okay, so you're getting close to it here with your displays.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay. So we've shown that, and then we've also got the original HD 709 100 nit display as the reference that we are normally used to seeing. We come down a little bit. We are also showing some of our cameras, the static displays. You can put it on your shoulder. We've also got one of our new R7 recorders that we have. And then we show different types of post-production color correction options, might I say. We have color front here, and we've also got our new RAW viewer running on a tangent display that you can utilize. And then that goes off to several of our home TV sets, which are actually available today. They're the
This is the X940D, right?
The D's, yes. Yeah. They're just starting, they're out at Best Buy right now. So the pictures are just phenomenal.
Now, I noticed in the display that we'll take a look at here, the consumer TVs are showing different types of high dynamic range. You've got one with HLG, hybrid log gamma, one with PQ, I guess?
Correct. That's absolutely correct. And we also have one running at just regular 24. So we have it at 24, 60, and 29.97. So the Katy Perry material is running at 29.97. The Jackson Hole material, That's running at 59.94. And then, like, the horse, the kids running through the poppy fields and stuff, that's at 120 played off at 24 frames.
Now, one of the announcements here at the show is a new OLED mastering monitor, 55-inch. You used to have the 30-inch, which is still out there, the X300. Now the X550. What can you tell us about it?
It's unbelievable. It is the unit that we are using for the quad split, so to speak. It is 50-inch. What's really neat is that it, because in 4K there are four quadrants, every quadrant has its own processor. This is really neat because we could have 1920 by 1080, 2398, 5994, 7.
You can have different frame rates in each of the quadrants.
720, and then what we were utilizing it for was different color spaces.
Wow, so a different color space in each quadrant.
On top of all that, yes. And you can also kick it back in to regular 4K. So you just see like gorgeous 4K material, high dynamic range.
Yeah. What's the peak brightness on it?
400 nits.
So that's getting up there for OLED, certainly. And how are you achieving, what display do you have close to 2020 on?
That will be on the BVM X300.
Okay. The smaller OLED.
It is our professional, the best of the best monitor that everybody is clamoring for. Even DITs, they're asking for them for their carts on set.
What distinguishes it then from the 550?
Well, the 550.
I mean, the 550 has a quad mode.
Correct. Still, this is the best of the best of the best.
Great. Well, it's always wonderful to visit Sony, and you guys always do great stuff. So, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so very much.
Here in the JVC booth, I'm chatting with Dave Walton, Assistant Vice President. And Dave, one of the big stories here at NAB is IP, Internet Protocol. All the studios, all the broadcasting, everybody's switching over to IP, and it offers some really interesting advantages.
It really does, and it's just in its infancy. We've been working on IP-based products now. A lot of people don't like to even mention the fact that we started this back in 2003 with a product called StreamCorder, a product that you could carry around, a camcorder, and stream live video and do reports from a convention show floor. At that time, we used Wi-Fi, but people were asking, what's Wi-Fi? They didn't know where to get it. They didn't know anything about it. Now we have Wi-Fi just about everywhere, and we can still stream from the cameras, but we've done a lot of things to improve those. And this year we've just gone completely crazy with all kinds of IP-based enhancements to our cameras, and we've also increased the reliability of the signal, because when you get into a convention center like this, it's just crazy the number of hotspots and SSIDs that are in use, and it's almost impossible to get a Wi-Fi signal. But we have systems here that can overcome that, so you can travel around the convention center or around a busy stadium and still have a good, strong signal.
Mm-hmm. And you were telling me offline that some of the other advantages are you don't have to carry around a lot of equipment anymore. You can have a lot of cameras in the field. Remind me about some of those things that we were talking about earlier.
Well, a good example, one of our customers, Bassmaster, does bass touring or bass competitions in bass boats. And they go out in boats where they can get an LTE signal. And there's nothing except one of these cameras with an LTE modem on it. And they're out doing bass fishing tournaments. And then they're sending that signal directly through the LTE network back to a facility somewhere. I don't know where it is. They call that at-home production because they can have multiple cameras in the field. They can do that. In fact, you'd have the cameras all over the country, really. You can have a camera in Chicago, New York, and Cleveland, and you can be streaming all from those cameras and then sitting in Cincinnati with a switcher, and that's where your program is produced. So you have all this capability because you have these networks, LTE networks and Wi-Fi networks available to you. So you're not tied down with all that equipment anymore.
And you can also, you were telling me, stream directly from the camera, say a television station has a YouTube channel or a website or whatever, you can stream directly there.
Yes, we in fact have a product called our Broadcaster. It's a rack mount server, and what it does is it allows a station that has, say, 16 cameras to send all those IP signals to a single IP address. They're identified, and then it's like a matrix switcher. You can assign outputs for those signals. So if, let's say you have a breaking news story. You have a reporter that is covering a big story. They'll stream for a couple of minutes a live report for the newscast, and they won't need a truck for that. It's just a live shot without the truck. But they can tell the viewers, we're going to continue our live coverage on our website, on our YouTube channel, on our Facebook page, because Facebook is now able to take live streams. And they can even send that same signal simultaneously to other TV stations in the group. So stations in other parts of the country can now take that same live signal. And it's all coming from a camera that's streaming live to a single server, and then that's routed out that way. It's incredible flexibility.
And you don't need a satellite truck or any kind of remote truck at all.
Not unless you have a lot of congestion or signal problems, but that's where these other products come in, because we've been working with partners like Silvus to develop what we call mesh networks, where you have a lot of congestion in a metro area. You can have your own private network. You're using the same technology in the camera to create the stream. The camera does the encoding, but you can put a radio on the camera then that can connect to a receiver that connects directly to hardwired internet, and you overcome all that congestion. One of the applications for this particular receiver, let's say you have a high school and you want to stream football games. Well, the stadium is 1,000 feet away from the building. They don't have Wi-Fi in the stadium, but they have a good network in the building. With a pair of these inexpensive Ubiquiti radios plugged into the camera, you can now get the signal to the network in the building and stream it out. In fact, we're so enamored with that idea, we developed a small camera that actually does score overlays in the camera. We call it the GYHM200SP, as in sports production. So a single user can shoot a football game, add score overlays with a clock and with a quarter flag, and all of that takes place in the camera. They can output the game right onto their YouTube channel, and they can have viewers and at the same time record on memory cards in the camera.
Right. As a backup.
Yes, absolutely. It's pretty flexible.
And so that's what you're showing really here behind us, is a sort of a simulation of a multi-camera shoot with everybody sharing their information over IP.
We have a number of displays here. One of them is that multi-camera shoot you're talking about. We have a NewTek TriCaster, which can accept the wireless streams from our cameras directly, decode those, and you can basically have a wireless multi-camera shoot. And we've added a feature this year. One of the new features we added is an IFB return audio channel. For viewers who don't know what IFB is, stands for interruptible foldback. It's the signal that a reporter hears in their earpiece coming back from the station. Well, that signal can come through our cameras now, through the wireless network, so there doesn't have to be a separate piece of equipment for that. It can either be a talent monitor, or in the case of a multi-camera shoot, you can use that from a director giving instructions to camera operators. So you do a concert, for example, and you have two or three cameras. You have a director who might be sitting in a different part of the city who is telling camera one, get this tight shot, camera two, need a wide shot on the drummer. All this can take place using IP directly from the internet to our cameras and without wires. It's incredible.
Well, it is a brave new world, and JVC seems to be at the forefront. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Scott.
I'm in the Harman Professional booth talking with Peter Chaikin, Director of Recording Solutions. And Peter, one of the things that's here at the show with Harman is the 7 Series speakers, which are so wonderful.
Thank you, Scott. Well, first of all, thanks for taking the time. We're very excited about these speakers. They're actually changing the lay of the land in the pro production community. When I say that, we make the tools that people use to create content in broadcast, in video and film post-production, and certainly in music production.
there are a lot of challenges in those environments, particularly in post and broadcast in the movie world. There are a few things that are going on. As we go into immersive audio formats, specifically Dolby Atmos, DTS:X, Barco Oro, we now have overhead speakers. So there's a lot more speakers in the environment. And where are you going to put them all? In a control room, a small control room. Well, it turns out that in the major cities, putting outlets in for powered speakers, which is kind of the norm in post, they're about $1,000 a piece to install. So there are a lot of hidden costs to putting in powered speakers. The other thing is that there are a lot of displays now in that environment, and the displays can block your sight lines, which means that you don't get to put a speaker where it really belongs. Another aspect is room to room, it's very hard to get consistent performance because the room plays into that quite a bit. So what we did was we designed a system from the ground up for post-production and broadcast, specifically for immersive audio production where there are more speakers. And the system is scalable and modular. We can build systems as small as two speakers, up to hundreds of speakers if we wanted to. There are facilities that actually have 32 speakers in a 12 by 12 foot room because they're doing quality control for all of these different formats. But the key point is it all starts with drivers, transducers. JBL has been making their own transducers for over 60 years now. Specifically, we're starting with a compression driver. The difference between a compression driver and the norm, what we typically use in a powered speaker, those are soft dome tweeters. They just don't have the output, and you have to protect them to keep them from overloading. As a result, one of two things happens. They either don't get loud enough or your working distance is limited. Those are one and the same. So we wanted to build very compact speakers that play 2 to 3 times louder than existing speakers. Now, loud isn't really the word we want to use, more dynamic range. And these do. They'll play 2 to 3 times louder than speakers their size, which means that now we can use them in place of larger speakers. We have a whole lot more freedom as to where to put them in the room. This waveguide is really where the magic happens. It creates the transition between the high and the low frequency. These are two-way speakers. We don't need to have a three-way speaker because with these drivers, we can cover the whole range from, well, these are minus 10 to 35. They go out to 36 kilohertz. Our biggest speaker, the M2, goes down to 20. And they're two-way speakers. So we have a lot of dynamic range in this high frequency. We had to design woofers to keep up. That was no easy trick. We play them for 100 hours. They can't blow up before they become a design. This waveguide is the marriage of these two drivers and also the marriage of the speakers in the room. And it also is responsible for the fact that we can actually put these in a broad range of spaces in the room and not worry about these displays because the imaging is so good and very, very forgiving. So the end result is we have a scalable modular system. It's externally powered. We use 8-channel outboard power amps that can be networked together. But specifically, how does this impact your readers? This technology is now finding its way into the home theater environment.
In fact, when I wrote about this is the 7 series, yes. Right? Derived from the M2. I wrote about it on AVS, and I immediately got a comment from a reader who had two M2s and a bunch of 708s and 705s in an Atmos configuration. I thought, wow, that's just beautiful.
In a home? Yeah, that's great. Well, and that's exactly what they were designed for. So, again, we in Pro make the tools that people use to create the content. In the home theater environment, you're creating a system for people to consume and enjoy the content. Speakers are the same. I mean, we've always believed that a good speaker for Pro can be used in the home. They may not be as living room friendly, but these are designed as a very next generation, a very high-tech tool. And it's kind of changing the lay of the land. You'll see these used in all the major post facilities now. They're in trucks. They're in lots of different places. So it's a natural that we would want these to go into home theater.
Now, another of the Harman brands, of the many Harman brands, is AKG, and you've introduced some new headphones at the show.
So there's been a desire at AKG to have a really wonderful reference flagship headphone, and from that, that technology would be used in other headphones eventually. Not so long ago, AKG invented a new 53-millimeter transducer. It's really the largest dynamic transducer used in headphones in the business, and it's stunning. And the first headphone using that transducer was called the KA-12. It's an open-back headphone. It's designed for a very broad range of applications, and it's stunning. It's very neutral, has a lot of detail. It's just beautifully, beautifully constructed, because we're really about three things. We're about performance, durability, and comfort. So it was designed to hit all those three price points, all those three conveniences and performance factors. But the thing is that an open-back headphone is not so friendly for studio applications. While it's wonderful to listen to and it's very, very neutral, when you're recording in front of a microphone, you want to make sure there's no sound coming out of the headphone and bleeding into the mic. Conversely, when you're recording or you're monitoring something critically and you want to hear the detail, you don't want a lot of sound coming into the headphones because you're just trying to isolate yourself. So I'd like to show you the K872. It's a closed-back version of a headphone using the same driver. I don't want to say it's the same as the KA-12. It's a little bit of a different animal, but it's also a flagship phone in a closed-back version. We just launched it. It's extraordinary.
Well, we'll take a look at that as we conclude our conversation here. We'll shoot some of that and overlay it here. But
can I give you some salient points about that?
Please do.
So the K872 is a closed-back headphone using a 53-millimeter transducer. It's very large. It also has a 1.5 Tesla magnet, which is very...
That's big.
It's very gutsy. At the same time, the phones have to be comfortable for long periods of time. So they're relatively light. All the parts are metal. You know, there's no breakable parts. The hinge is a cardan hinge. Beautifully designed. Everything's beautifully engineered. The cord is removable, and it uses a beautiful LIMO connector, you know, very precise connector. The headband is mesh, and the ear cups are they're slow retention ear cups that seal very well, but they're also very comfortable. And the end result is a headphone that's very comfortable, very light. You don't feel this thing weighing on your head. It's adjustable. The driver gives you extraordinary frequency response, 5 hertz to greater than 50 kilohertz. Yeah. Very neutral, wonderful dynamic range, and also the headphones are very durable, because the people that are using these, the pros that are using these, you know, they get into some pretty rough situations. They get dropped. They're using them with laptops. They're moving place to place. They come in a beautiful case for transport. It's also a stand. But this is a flagship for us. It's the top of the line. At the same time, AKG recently, the same transducer engineers, designed headphones at the very entry level price points that are really changing the lay of the land at those price points. When you listen to them, it's similar to what's happening at JBL in terms of what you can do, what we can do at low price points will knock your socks off and be very, 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 very good. Whereas things at low prices just never really, you know, they were headphones, but they never really were usable by pros.
Speaking of price points and delivery, when are these going to be available and how much are they going to cost?
So they will be available in June, and they're $1,500 per pair.
Well, that's not cheap for a pair of headphones, but look what you're getting.
At the entry level, again, the same engineers designed headphones at $39, $49, and $59 per pair. And you'll be really, really impressed with them. So AKG is just on fire in terms of their development and hitting the mark in the market right now.
Well, AKG's always been big in the broadcast industry. I mean, Leo Laporte, the guy who runs Twit Network, has had AKGs in his studio for a very long time. So it's a long history and a fine tradition, and glad to see that it's moving forward.
Yeah, and there's a lot more to come. It's a great time for Harman brands in particular, but AKG and JBL being the transducer brands, you'll see a lot of great things coming from us. It's a great, great team.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Scott. Appreciate it.
Well, that's it from NAB 2016. I hope you've enjoyed our tour, talking about all the great stuff that's going to affect what you see and hear in the commercial cinema and at home. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Florian Friedrich, a world-renowned calibrator, to talk about high dynamic range calibration. So I do hope you will join me for that. Until then, geek out.